The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Hi, this is Kevin McCullough. Thanks for listening to the Christian Outlook podcast, where we cover today's issues from a perspective that honors your Christian faith. Our podcast is brought to you through a partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. Here's another piece I trust you'll enjoy.
Oz Guinness, he got his Doctor of Philosophy from Oxford. He was born in China and educated, as I've already told you, in England. He's the author of more than 30 books. I could go on and on, but why should I? Because he's right here. Oz Guinness, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Eric.
I'm so happy to have you. We are also friends. I've been privileged to know you for a long time. You write what I would call important books, and you, in your previous book, titled A Free People's Suicide, helped me to see some things about my own country, which changed my life and led me to write my own book, If You Can Keep It. I know that in the new book, Carpe Diem, Redeemed, you do something like that. First of all, let's talk about this book. For someone who knows nothing about it, what is it about? It says Seizing the Day, Discerning the Times is the subtitle.
Well, you know, Carpe Diem has become a sort of catchword today. Dead Poets Society, many people having the tattoo on their body. But often in a secular world, carpe diem becomes sort of grab it while you can. Life is short, grab it. Whereas if you think a Jewish Christian, a biblical view of time, contrasted with the Eastern view of time and with the secularist view of time, The biblical view of time is so much richer and deeper. So I'm trying to put that biblical view back on the map.
Okay, so the Latin carpe diem means literally seize the day. And you're right, it's become a catchword, meaning in a sense seize the moment. It almost means like, you know, grab pleasure, do what you can while you can because time is fleeting. And of course, there's some truth in that, but you're talking about something much deeper.
Absolutely. You know, the idea started to come to me some years ago. I was coming from Brussels to London on the Eurostar. And as you enter St. Pancras Station, there's graffiti of all sorts. But there was one that was legible. You only live once, and you can't take it with you. So live it up, drink it down, laugh it off, burn it at both ends. You can't take it with you. You only live once. That's the so-called YOLO philosophy.
The YOLO philosophy.
Which is really incredibly stupid. It's a sort of bastard form of Epicurus, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. Now, for all of us, life is short, and it's vulnerable, and so the question is, how do we make the most of it and live wisely and well? And once again, I think the biblical view helps us to do that in a way that no other faith and worldview does.
Well, then tell us about that. How does the biblical worldview help us seize the day, as it were, but in a true way? The title of the book, if I wasn't clear, is Carpe Diem, Redeemed. So you're trying to give us the deeper idea. So then what is the biblical idea?
Well, think of the secularist view first. There is no meaning in time or history unless you give it meaning. So you've got to grab it by yourself. I used to have Bertrand Russell teaching, and he always had the picture of the Greek giant Atlas, who carried his own world on his own shoulders.
I'm sorry, you had Bertrand Russell as a professor?
Taught a seminar, yeah.
You're kidding.
Not fully for a term, but he'd give a seminar at London University.
I'm just amazed. I keep forgetting that he was alive into the 1970s. I forgot about that. Yeah,
I was a student in the 60s,
yeah,
and so I remember him well. But you can see that. It's often called the redemptive view of history. The secularists have to grab history by the scruff of the neck and make what they make of it. Now, you have optimists, much fewer left today, like, say, Steven Pinker at Harvard, and many pessimists, like Samuel Beckett. You know, what is time? Is history a tale told by an idiot, sound and fury signifying nothing? No, the Bible says. History has meaning. There's purpose in it. God's providence overlaps it, and he invites us to know him and to become partners with him into working into history. And that's the whole notion of calling.
It's interesting because the idea, the secular idea, what most secular ideas, most people who claim to live by them can't really. In other words, they can't really face the naked horror of a life that is genuinely meaningless, in which we have to create our own meaning. Most people don't live that way. They sort of borrow from the biblical view because it's too frightening. It's too horrifying to live a life in which there genuinely is no meaning.
No, absolutely. And you actually have leading atheists today, John Gray at the London School of Economics, who says that much optimistic humanism is actually a parasite on the Christian faith. It borrows hope. Because, as you said, you can't live with the bleakness that there's no meaning to it. Joseph Heller, you know, history is a trash bag of coincidences blown open by the wind. Well, who can live with a miserable view of life like that? In the biblical view, there are evils, there are shocks, there are disappointments, but God's providence is overall, and history has great meaning.
Well, so tell us then, what else do you say in the book? Because I certainly agree with your thesis, but what else do you say about it?
Well, there's a whole lot of the aspects of a biblical view of history. Just take one of them that applies today. The often quoted principle that the end is not the end. A lot of Christians are very discouraged and demoralized today. We may be seeing the end of the greatness of the American Republic. We may be seeing the end of the Western civilization. Just as St. Augustine lived to see the end after 800 years of Rome. But always in the world, there are ends of that first sense, endings, full stop, periods, conclusions. Always. Summer ends, you have autumn. Autumn ends and winter. They're ending. Our lives will end in that way. But then the other meaning of the word end is telos, your Greek word, which means end as climax, culmination, objective. And the Lord is always working out his purposes. So there may be endings of the first sort,
right,
but he always has endings of the second sort. And so we're people of hope, whatever.
We're people of hope, whatever happens, right. Well, again, there are many people who they don't feel confident in believing that fully. In other words, there are many detractors who would say, look, I cannot see God's hand in history. It does seem like a grab bag blown open by the wind. It doesn't seem to make sense. How do you make sense of it? Why do you say that it does make sense?
Well, we always add in providence. In other words, it isn't all up to us. Getting to know God isn't up to us. He reveals himself and rescues us and so on. But history is not all up to us. And at the end of a great end, you have the Jewish and Christian notion of the Messiah. For us, the Messiah coming back again. But that providential ending and that, you know, the notion of apocalypse. Today, because of the films and so on, people think of apocalypse as catastrophe, disaster. But the biblical view is unveiling. And when the Messiah returns, there'll be a grand unveiling, and then we'll see the purposes of God. At the moment, we're looking at the bottom side of a carpet, all a mess of the knots
right.
and everything. You can't see the pattern. But when there's an unveiling of God's meaning at the end of time, then we'll see the real meaning of it all, because his providence has been working out right through the middle of it.
It's only because I've been studying Homer in these last few years that I know that the word calypso means hidden, and apocalypse is about what is hidden, so that the apocalypse is the revelation of those things which have been hidden. It's interesting to think that. In other words, that those who don't discern meaning in history, that we can say to them, well, in part, you're right. There's much that has been hidden from us. We have just enough to know that there's something, but we don't have the full picture. So that's mm-hmm. true.
No, exactly. One of the great historians talks of history as terror, because we're disappointed and shocked and there's evil and all sorts of things go wrong. How can anyone see hope in this mess? You look at the 20th century, genocides, war, massacres, you name it. Things like 9/11, more locally, and so on. And yet, for the believer, history is a task, because there is meaning. We don't know the full meaning now, But trusting God, we work in, do our part with our individual callings. That, and history is no longer a terror. It's a task.
The second chapter of the book is titled Survival of the Fastest. What do you mean by survival of the fastest?
Well, obviously, a feature of our advanced modern world is what's called fast life. Instant, 24/7 pressure. And that is created by the clock. Now, the clock was invented around 1400 in Europe, and many historians say it's the most important invention Europe ever made. But it's the 19th century when the clock coordinated things through railways, railway timetables, and so on. And now, of course, with atomic-level timing. If you go back to your American explorers, Lewis and Clark, they agreed to meet at a certain place on a certain day, and they were 9 days apart, their plan, and they describe it in their journal as relatively punctual. 9 days apart. But can you imagine trying to dock a space station 9 days apart? They'd be dead. And we're living in this world of atomic timing, of instant pressure, and so on. And you can think of people looking at their phones 100 times a day. Marx called people wage slaves, but in many ways today we are time slaves.
That's a horrifying thought. So what should we do about it?
Well, we've got to re-explore notions, again, biblical notions, yeah. Like the Sabbath.
Yeah. Well, what about the Sabbath? I mean, the Sabbath seems to have fallen on hard times in our culture. I know when you think of, for example, as recently as Eric Little in the 1924 Olympics, his idea of the Sabbath was so serious. He took it so seriously, and the people, the Christians around him, took it so seriously that he was willing to give up a gold medal in the Olympics, willing to be hated by many people who thought that he ought to have put his country before this silly notion of the Sabbath. But he took it so seriously that he was willing to refuse to run on that day, and of course God redeemed it dramatically and beautifully. But most Christians today, serious Christians, don't have anything approaching that kind of a view of the Sabbath. What do you think about it?
Well, the trouble was it became sort of legalistic, and then people wanted to get away from all forms of legalism, so they threw it out. Yeah. But actually you see more and more people taking to it again, take cell phones. It's actually a wonderful thing to be free from emails or cell phones on the Sabbath, on a Sunday, and have one day when you're clear of it.
Yeah.
And actually more and more people are doing that. But of course that in the Bible is only one part of that rhythm and renewal, rest and renewal. And you see, for example, the nation needed to have the Torah read to it every 7 years. What if America had its Constitution or the Declaration read every 7 years? And you have these moments of rededication and renewal and rest, and we need to see those are incredibly important.
It's interesting because I've never thought of it that way, that the Sabbath is a time, it's not just to rest, but in a way to recalibrate our position, so to speak, to say, have I drifted? To read the Torah, obviously, is to bring you back to the Word of God and to what He says. To read the Constitution would be pretty spectacular because it would first of all teach those of us who don't know the Constitution what the Constitution says. But I'm not sure what it is that God calls us to do today on the Sabbath. There are different views of it, but it seems to me that most Christians have really thrown out the idea of Sabbath. That it just seems not to apply any more than laws against eating shellfish apply.
Mm-hmm. But put another way, Eric, where we are with the crisis of the West and in America, we need to live an alternative way, a counterculture. And so we need to build back in the foundations that are biblical. And so my little attempt here is to restore a biblical Christian view of time and history. But there are many other things, of human dignity, of freedom, of justice, and things like that. Because we have the deepest answers to the deepest challenges that our modern world is raising. And yet Christians are often on their back foot, as if they have to be defensive.
Yeah.
Whereas truly, the good news of Jesus is the best news ever. And as we put it forward its positive aspects, it's incredible. And time is just one more of them.
Well, I want to ask you, when we talk about biblical worldview, I immediately think today of China. The way they treat prisoners, the way they treat people who dare to dissent against the state, the way they've treated the Uyghur, the Muslims, the Falun Gong people, the Tibetan Buddhists, and of course Christians, they have a different worldview. You grew up in China. You suffered. Your family suffered. I don't know if you're willing to talk about that.
Well, take my great. My grandfather was one of the first Western doctors in China. My grandma, he died before I was born. But my grandmother would tell us the story. He'd go and say the Imperial Palace, a serving girl might spill the tea and immediately be taken outside, thrust headfirst down a well, left to die. Life was cheap. And you can see that they don't have a view. And you remember that our biblical view, Rabbi Sacks calls Genesis 1, the Magna Carta of humanity. Every single human being, badly educated, desperately crippled, impoverished financially, they're still precious and unique. That is increasingly important. So we often talked before of a post-truth world. We're now moving into a post-rights world because people can't give a basis for why there's a precious uniqueness to the individual. And once again, Jews and Christians, biblical people, we have that foundation, and we've got to stand for it. And that was the problem in China then, and it's certainly the problem now. In Mao Zedong, to make an omelet, you have to break eggs. Well, he may have killed 60 to 75 million of his fellow Chinese. But make no mistake, there are things in the West where we now have a rather cheap view of human nature.
Well, there's no question about it, and I don't want to divert you from those things. I just think that since you grew up in China and suffered as a young kid there, your parents suffered it. I just want to highlight that because so many people are ignorant of when you take a biblical worldview thoroughly out of a culture. And you begin to say that, listen, every human being is not made in the image of God. We don't believe in the idea of God. And therefore, every human being is really just what we say it is. And so we can take prisoners and we can say you forfeited your life and we'll use your organs. Horrific things, but they are consonant with that worldview.
Absolutely.
And we have to understand that every worldview, I learned this from you, ideas have consequences, and every worldview has to be taken seriously because it leads to those kinds of things.
Well, the one that's absolutely relevant right now is the notion of revolutions. Because if you look at the big five, you've got the English, 1642, the American, 1776, the French, 1789, the Russian and the Chinese. And as a boy, I remember 70 years ago this year, my dad saying to me, son, we're in trouble. Chiang Kai-shek has just flown to Taiwan. In other words, we were left at the mercy of the incoming Red Army, and the Reign of Terror began. But the first two revolutions were biblical. Through the invention of printing, and more importantly, the Reformation, the English Revolution, although it failed, and the American one, which succeeded gloriously, were biblical revolutions. Whereas the French, the Russian, and the Chinese were not. And among many differences, you have that espousal of violence. And you can see the danger of that today in America. America's in danger of shifting from understanding the republic and freedom from the perspective of 1776 and the American Revolution to understanding it from the perspective of the French Revolution. So things like the sexual revolution, political correctness, identity politics, they have nothing to do with the American Revolution and everything to do with ideas that have come from the French Revolution. Take, say, the letter of Paul to the Galatians. He says, who's bewitched you? You're following another gospel. And, as a European, I come different parts of this country, and I'd almost like to say, who's bewitched you? Don't you realize you're following another revolution? This is not the American Revolution. The trouble is there's no one speaking at the highest levels for the American Revolution and its distinctives today.
Well, I know that you and I do what we can, but we are not at the highest level, and we need louder voices, more prominent voices. What I say in my book, If You Can Keep It, and in other places, I get mostly from you. And I say that to underscore the horror of being able to avoid these ideas as a student in America, how easy it is to miss these things and how we all need to wake up. Oz, you came of age in the 60s, and you saw how for the first time Eastern ideas came into the West, bringing with them all kinds of things, transcendental meditation, yoga. It's a completely different worldview that was really foreign to the West, which had mainly a biblical worldview, until about 50 years ago. It's amazing mm-hmm. to realize that we're living in a time when that it has had a huge effect on how we think. So talk a little bit about the Eastern view of things versus the Western view.
Well, the Eastern view of time is quite different. It's based on the notion of a wheel. So history and time are a wheel going round and round. So desire leads to craving, leads to attachment, which binds us to the wheel. And the goal is to escape the wheel. You might go around 18,000 times, Hindus say. So the goal is to escape from that. But here's the problem. In the East, freedom is not freedom to be an individual. It's freedom from being an individual, because being an individual is being caught in that world of illusion on the wheel.
That but seems when, like a very subjective idea. In other words, where do they get the idea? I mean, it just seems to me, maybe because I've been propagandized by living in the West, that to be an individual is the greatest thing. The God that I worship is an individual, is a person. And to disappear into the cosmos, to become one with everything, as they sometimes say, to me seems like genuine death. But no,
they don't see it that way. I obviously agree with you. I went out to study under a guru in the late 60s to find why so many Westerners went to the East. And one of my conclusions was that many of them go to the East by force of reaction. The West is driven, noisy, activist, anxious. So you go to the East for meditation and rest. So the people I met were all aware of what they were against, but not all that aware of what they were into. And that's the problem. You can see people today taking to mindfulness or getting to yoga and so on, not realizing where the philosophy actually leads to. And that's the dilemma. It's very, very different. So the Bible's view of history, moving with purpose, each of us have a calling to make a point in our lives in history. That's unique. You go back to the Egyptians and the Babylonians and various others, the notion of a cycle was very common.
But it's very fatalistic, isn't it?
Oh, terribly.
I mean, in other words, it really seems to suggest that nothing matters, let go, stop fighting. It is fatalist. In other words, if I were, you know, you brought me one of the greatest gifts of my life is knowledge and understanding of the life of William Wilberforce. And I think to myself, what if he hadn't felt God calling him to eradicate this horrible evil of the slave trade? Imagine if he had been a Buddhist or had an Eastern view of things and said, everything's just working itself out. Mm-hmm. This will take care of itself. The slaves, the African slaves are suffering because they're on this karmic wheel. They sort of deserve to suffer. They do deserve to suffer, and I don't want to mess with it.
But widen it from what you're saying, Eric, and that is the fatalism, the determinism is much wider than just the East. So the Babylonians, everything's in the stars. Even in your ancestors in Greek, take, say, Oedipus, fate, Moira, destiny. You know, even our modern atheists, you think as modern people, we all believe in freedom. Not at all. You look at the new atheists like Sam Harris, the front cover of his book is a puppet dangling on strings. Freedom, he says, is an illusion. You will not find a grounding for freedom except in the Bible. And that's a stunning thing to say, but it's true. And Westerners just take freedom for granted. But where did it come from? We're increasingly a cut flower civilization.
Well, talk more about that, because I've also borrowed that from you many times. It's a great image of a cut flower, meaning it looks beautiful. It is a flower. It's full of life. But the life is limited. It's already dying because it's been cut from its roots. That to me it, when you say that we have this idea of freedom, we say we love freedom, but we have no idea where it comes from. We just grab it without realizing that it's vanishing unless we reconnect to the roots mm-hmm. that gave us freedom.
Yeah. I mean, the essence, say, the story of Exodus, which is the master story of Western freedom. The story is of a free God rescuing his people to freely worship and live before him freely. It's all about freedom. You know, some Christians say to me, well, God isn't that concerned with freedom. And I say, well, all right, you use the word sovereignty. That's another word for freedom. God can express and exert his will despite all resistance and interference. He is free. You know, the Jews translate Exodus 3:14, not just I am who I am, but I will be who I will be. I am free, the Lord is saying. And we're made in his image.
That I have never seen that before. And again, leave it to you to give me something precious and new. The idea that freedom and sovereignty are effectively the same thing. In other words, sovereignty isn't fatalistic. God has freedom, and he has the sovereignty to impose his wonderful freedom on us. But he's not stuck doing that. It's we're talking about generationalism, progressivism. Take us in that direction.
Well, part of the impact of clock time is that it puts its stamp on everything. So the latest must be greatest. The newer must be truer. And so you have both, say, in religion, in the church, but also in politics, a progressivism. So any change must be changed for the better. But that's nonsense. You know, you've got to say, are we progressing or are we regressing? You've got to have a standard by which to judge if you're going forwards or backwards.
Right.
And yet people say, well, you're on the wrong side of history, and that's the end of the argument.
Well, they have an idea that wherever we're going is better than where we are or where we've come from, which is absolute nonsense. Where do they get that idea from?
From the Enlightenment.
Yeah.
The Enlightenment idea of progress is exactly what you've described. In other words, the Enlightenment tried to replace God with reason and providence with progress and things like this. And this idea that we're moving, you know, Martin Luther King, he pointed out that those who talk about the arc of history bending towards justice and so on, many of them use that phrase like President Obama often did, but they don't have a basis philosophically for knowing that history is going towards justice. Now, we do as biblical people, because God is over history, and one day there will be justice and tears wiped away. But for an atheist, they can't say that, and yet they do say it.
Well, there's an irony, too, because when we talk about things getting better, part of the reason we think that, because sometimes it's true, of course, things do get better, is because of the free market. In other words, in the free market, if I can create something that's better than what already exists, I will make money. And so there's a huge incentive to create something that's better. If I have a product on my own, I've created a product, I want to make an improved product so that next year people will buy my product. And so we have observed in the West things getting better because of the free market to some extent. And so there are reasons people think that way, but they're not really looking at why they think that way. They're just making a broader assumption mm-hmm. based on those observations.
Yeah, there's no question that technology does go like that.
Yeah.
But you don't have moral progress to keep up with the technological progress, and that's increasingly the challenge of where we're going.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, is that, you know, things, let's put it this way, the free market, and again, I learned this really from you, is that when you take morality and virtue out of the free market, when you take morality and virtue out of self-government and democracy, those things quickly devolve and things get worse. There's a great irony, right? Mm-hmm. So the free market, left to its own devices, will eventually create a worse world, not a better world, unless we're grounded in virtue. But those are ideas that, you know, I talk about this all the time. They have been forgotten by the ruling classes. I mean, most of the people on the GOP side don't seem to get this. I mean, they seem to think that democracy would erupt if we just took out this dictator or that dictator. They don't really seem to understand that virtue is at the heart of those things.
Well, that's incredibly naive. Look at what we did in Iraq. People were so excited when they saw the Iraqis voting, the same way that William Wordsworth was ecstatic when he looked at the French Revolution. And Edmund Burke said, wait a minute. What you're seeing is the wild gas of liberty, but without the right assumptions, foundations, it'll lead, as it did, to the Reign of Terror. And look what's happening in much of the color revolutions and so on. Eric, the way I put this, you might be intrigued, is, you know, someone has said, we are now post-Auschwitz, post-Hiroshima, and pre-singularity. And you sort of summarize the challenges of humanity in that. Post-Auschwitz. What does it say of us as humans that the people who did that, they're the same species we are? Post-Hiroshima, what does it mean that with our defenses now, we obliterate not just the enemy, but much of the earth if we want to defend ourselves? And pre-singularity, you know, C.S. Lewis talked about when the conquest of nature becomes the conquest of human nature, and you have what Lewis called a master generation that can change all future generations without their consent, and with transhumanism tying ourselves into the machine. You know, it was profound questions, and I would argue humanism, secularism, has no answer to some of these things. And you've only got an answer in the depth of the truth of the Bible.
Well, it's funny because, as I was saying to you earlier, my daughter is in college now. She's taking a course where she's forced to read all of this horrific, these horrific writings on futurism. So it's 1911, I think, that a guy named, is it Farinetti? I can't remember the name. But this Italian futurist, and it's the same thing that we're talking about here, except with the wild eyes of 1911, where you're living before you've seen the fruits of these horrible ideas. And so this utopianist idea that technology is going to conquer everything and it's wonderful and we've got this brave new future to look forward to, and to read it 100 years later is to cringe, because you see these ideas over and over. They have not been self-critical. They haven't said, well, where will this lead? Where will technology lead, for example? They're not really willing to do that, and they seem simply to be reacting to what they didn't like.
And then you think of how the 20th century showed up many of these ideas for their bankruptcy.
Precisely.
World War I was shattering. You know, and you had the distancing of humanity, and Einstein saying, I wish we could look at humanity from Mars so that we didn't have to be quite so identified. Then the 30s and 40s, the rise of totalitarianism and books like Brave New World and so on and so on. And then the 60s with the nuclear disaster and now transhumanism. These are titanic questions, and most worldviews are left in the dust. They can't answer these questions. I think only the biblical view has the strength to look them in the white of the eye and give answers.
I certainly agree. It seems to me that these Enlightenment ideas, these bad ideas, this French Revolution model of revolution has gained the upper hand in American life today. What do you say about that?
Well, sadly, I have to agree with you. And what makes me really sad is that America's as deeply divided as at any time since just before the Civil War. Different reasons. But there's a huge difference, and that is no Lincoln. Because what Lincoln did, he addressed the evils, say, of slavery then in the light of the Declaration, but in the light of what he called the better angels of the American experiment. No one's doing that now. So even, say, take Make America Great Again, the gentleman doesn't ask what made America great in the first place. That's what needs to be renewed and restored. And I challenge leaders in Washington, which will you, of you will play the Lincoln and address these real issues?
Well, it's interesting. I think that President Trump assumes a lot. In other words, he's not the sort to explicate these things, but he assumes certain things. And then there are people on the other side who assume the opposite, right? They say, make America great again. What do you mean? Taking us back to Jim Crow, taking us back to slavery. What do you mean? When were we great? He doesn't really defend himself ideologically. But I do think that there are people out there doing that, just not on the level of
the
a Lincoln.
Level.
No, not on the highest level. Is there anybody that you know in Washington who might?
There are a few who are capable of it. You know, people who know history, like, say, Senator Ben Sasse and others. But we need much, much more of that.
But his criticisms of the president strike me as crude and unnecessary. In other words, I don't think that the people who might have something to say, I don't think that they do themselves or their ideas a favor by the way they've been expressing them. So I think I've been disappointed
in him
and others.
Well, he hasn't addressed the better angels.
Right.
In other words, rather than... The never-Trumpers make a huge mistake. They're so obsessed with him, they don't see the real problem. In other words, the ideas from the French Revolution are winning almost every day, and people are so obsessed with the president that they're ignoring the real cancer that's going on underneath. That's the trouble with the never-Trumpers.
What are some of the examples of this cancer? What do you mean?
Well, take some of the features of what's come down from the French ideas. It's a different source, the Enlightenment, not the Bible. You have a different view of humanity, separation of powers in the Constitution, utopianism in the other one. But take some of the specifics today. Power at the expense of truth. There is no truth. Everything's a matter of power. Or another one. In the biblical views, you work for reconciliation. You address evils. You hope for repentance and forgiveness and reconciliation, restoration. And you can see Martin Luther King, Booker T. Washington, Frederick Douglass. They all talk like that. Today, reparation, retaliation. They're making the problem worse, not better. Or another key feature, what's coming from the left, violence as opposed to civility. When words break down, we're never far from violence. And you can see that it comes in first. You make excuses for the excesses. They've been suffering terribly, so who can blame them for this, whatever. And then you get the sort of, what's said, the sacralizing of violence. You know, those who die are martyrs, and those who are killed are scapegoats. And my fear is that there's going to be another assassination in this country.
I want to
growing out of the implacable hatred.
Oz, we've got a few minutes left. I want to continue the conversation. We're talking about what's happening today in the United States. We're talking about the Never Trumpers. Now, when you say you think they're wrong, what do you mean by that?
Well, the Never Trumpers are so obsessed with the president that they're ignoring, on the one hand, the policies, the things he's doing that are pretty good. But on the other hand, they're ignoring the real trends where these progressive, secular, left-wing ideas are taking over more and more. Take the Kavanaugh hearings and so on. And if they predominate, it's the end of the American Republic.
But don't you think that that is why Trump was elected? Because your average American has finally seen the horror that many in the GOP simply couldn't care less or are blind to what is really going on. And they have failed over and over and over to address the monstrosities that have been growing. I mean, the idea that we could have Kavanaugh attack that way with no evidence and that people are effectively told, shut up, you must believe the woman. You might as well be living in North Korea or in China during the Cultural Revolution. All the ideas that have made us who we are as a people are quickly thrown in the garbage so that the right to abortion can stay alive. In other words, for any reason, and it just seems to me that so many Americans have seen through this, and so they see people like Mitt Romney and others, and they've said, you're not doing it, you're not getting it done. We want somebody who's going to get it done, and we're going to take somebody who in many ways might be flawed, but he does seem to get these things.
Oh, I've made that argument for quite a while. You know, I think President Trump, his election was kind of like the wrecking ball that stopped America in that progressive left-wing tracks. But you've got to use the 4 years, and they're almost over, use those 4 years of breathing space to address the real issues in the light of the first principles, and that has not happened. At the moment, it's still Democrat, Republican,
right,
left, right, hang him anyway. Where is the Lincoln? Where are the... Where are there better angels? Someone's got to address that. It'll soon be too late.
Well,
in other words, you could have the worst thing of all would be a recoil against the president, which would accelerate the movement in the other way.
Well, that seems to be what is happening
on one side.
On one side. Mm-hmm. I guess what fascinates me is how many people on the left, I think, even if their criticisms of the president were correct, they've made it worse. They've been guilty of precisely the same thing. In other words, they haven't acted with civility or respect. And so in a way, they've goaded him to behave just as he has. And he's a little bit better at it than they are. And so the battle just continues.
Yeah, that won't be the way out for America.
No.
I mean, you can take issues like, say, the wall. It's discussed in terms of walls and sanctuary cities. The real issue is citizenship. That's why you need a boundary. Those inside become Americans and know why they're Americans. Or you take, say, the Kaepernick stuff. You know, the kneeling controversy should be about the Declaration. And what's radically dangerous in what Kaepernick and others have done is that they've disrespected the standard. Martin Luther King called the Declaration the promissory note. Wasn't cashed in and now needs to be cashed in. But Kaepernick and others are disrespecting the promissory note. But no one puts the issues in terms of American first principles. You know, I'm a European admirer of this country, but again and again, I'm sometimes sad and sometimes outraged that people don't address the first principles.
Well, it doesn't seem that there are many forums in which to do that. In other words, it seems that both sides are just shouting at each other or fighting the daily battle and not stepping back to frame it.
But there are places and there are people who should do better.
Yeah, give me an example. Where could someone give a speech like this?
On Capitol Hill, you could be. I mean, wish that the State of the Union was truly the State of the Union.
Yeah.
And so on. There are many, many cases where it could be done, but it simply isn't.
I guess the willingness of folks to burn down everything, in a sense, because of their opposition to this president is very troubling to me. In other words, it seems that, I mean, for example, Nixon in 1960 had enough information to contest the vote with Kennedy, to say, in fact, Kennedy's side cheated. I should be the president. And that may well have been completely correct. But he chose not to do it simply because he thought it would drag the country through such division and horror that it would have a very bad effect. Mm-hmm. That, to me, is a noble thing for whatever one thinks of Nixon.
And that's at the heart of it today. And, you know, the thing that actually the two inflammatory words are Trump and Brexit. But what actually links them is the fact that in both cases, the losing side didn't agree. And you can see in England, the Remainers were defeated, and they've caused this chaos in Britain, which is really damaging the country. And here the Democrats didn't accept their election defeat. Now, both of those are very dangerous because democracy means you should have a loyal opposition and not resistance. And to take a word like that, which was the way people resisted the Nazis, tells you how far we've gone.
It's unbelievable. I mean, it's scandalous that they would take that word, which was really a noble resistance to a satanic totalitarianism, and apply it to this president. It does show you how we've cheapened words in general. I mean, it's you can't even compare the two. But it does betray things. In other words, when we think of the story in Scripture of Solomon and the baby, the woman, when Solomon says, well, okay, you say it's your baby, you say it's your baby, here's what we'll do. We'll cut the baby in half and we'll give half to each person. One of the women says, no, 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 don't kill the baby, you take it. Solomon immediately knows that's the mother, that's the real mother. And it seems to me that there are people today who are really saying, I'm happy to burn the whole thing down. If I can't win, I don't want anyone to win. And that's, to me, this idea behind saying, I don't care what happens to the country, I simply want to win. It's fundamentally un-American. And it, to me, if I didn't know anything, I would say it seems to me that those people something's not right, because they don't seem to care about the fabric of the nation. They just care about winning now.
Absolutely. No, I couldn't agree with you more. But, Eric, I would say we're at a time of such dire emergency. We need to go back again to foundations. And I'm impressed. The roots of our American, in this case, freedom, go back to Exodus. And there's a huge amount there. We talked in an earlier segment about the basis of humans being free, made in the image of God. You could take the covenant as a framework for freedom and as a basis for reciprocal solidarity. In Exodus, you have not a welfare state, but a welfare society. And you've got all sorts of incredible first lessons and the challenge to transmission. Freedom and faith both have to be handed on in every generation, or they go. You see that again in Exodus. What did Moses talk about the night of the Passover? Not freedom, not the promised land. He talked about children. And you can see that transmission has broken down in America. And I sort of challenge people. We've got to think first principles, realize where we've come from. Do we want to go back and rededicate ourselves, renew the American experiment? Well, someone's got to articulate what these great foundations are and not just lament the darkness,
although you,
but point towards the light.
You mentioned Lincoln. Lincoln, he said what he said, but he also understood that in order to keep the Union together, a war had to be fought. He didn't shrink from fighting the war. In other words, making peace with your enemy doesn't mean not fighting your enemy sometimes. Sometimes the peace comes out of the war. It seems to me that there's some parallel with where we are now. In other words, yeah. If somebody is, you know, prosecuting a war, you have to decide, how do we fight or do we let them win? What do we do? And this kind of resistance seems to be at war with some of the foundational principles of the country.
No, that's right. There's a time for peace, peace when there is no peace. And you've got to point out the errors of it. I mean, you take, say, Pax Romana, the Roman peace. As the Romans themselves said, pacification was the peace of despotism. And you can see whether it's Thomas Hobbes or the Old Testament itself or history at other points, if we have this constant fighting, the Cold Civil War as it's called, what it will lead to is a new authoritarianism, a new tyranny. And that's another Leviathan. And that would be incredibly dangerous. We needn't go that way if you have leadership now.
We're out of time. Oz Guinness, my friend, thank you so much.
Always a pleasure.
Folks, the book is Carpe Diem Redeemed. Get a copy.
Thanks for listening to Christian Outlook. Our program is coming to you today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's America's most unique graduate leadership programs offered on Pepperdine's breathtaking campus in Malibu, California. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. If you enjoy our podcast, take a moment and tell a friend to subscribe today.